At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What are the chances? Now that Senate leaders have decided to put off a vote on extending the Bush administration's tax cuts, what are the chances your taxes might go up on January 1st? Democrats are still promising to come back after the election and at least extend the lower rates for the middle class, but they're still split on whether the rich deserve the same treatment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. And by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. We made it to Friday and glad to have you with us on this 24th of September. Senate leaders have decided not to touch those controversial expiring Bush tax cuts before the November election. But wait, they're still promising a lame duck session before all those freshly elected members of Congress take their seats in January. So what are the prospects for those tax cuts during that lame duck session? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The hope is that lawmakers no longer facing an election can find compromise. Government scholar William Galston at the Brookings Institution says lame duck legislators are freer to vote their principles.
There are some Democrats who genuinely believe raising taxes on anybody during a recession may not be the best or wisest policy. And there are still some Republicans who believe that deficits matter.
If Republicans gain political clout on Election Day, they'll figure they have the votes to cut taxes for everyone next year. Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian at Princeton, says that won't be lost on lame duck Democrats either.
They'll see that the country, in their minds, has moved to the right. They'll be worried about the implications for President Obama in 2012, and there'll be a lot of reasons that they'll want to be cautious rather than bold, even though they don't have to worry about re-election.
But newly empowered Republicans might be less willing to compromise in a lame duck session. They could allow the tax cuts to expire for everyone, figuring they'll cut them retroactively in the next Congress. But former George Bush advisor Matt Slaughter worries delay could hurt the economy.
It's important to keep in mind there's millions of American businesses and households for whom all this uncertainty is not a good thing.
And that uncertainty could continue well past a lame duck session. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Tax cuts or hikes notwithstanding, we learned today that 25 executives at Citigroup will be taking home millions more. The biggest raise is going to the man in charge of serving the bank's big institutional clients. He's getting a salary in cash and stock of $9.5 million, plus a likely bonus of $4.75 million. In case you'd lost track of this as a taxpayer, the government does still own a 17% stake in Citigroup. By the way, Citi CEO Vikram Pandit again declined a raise. His annual salary remains $1. Call it a stock offering on steroids. An oil company in Brazil has raised more than $70 billion on the market. That is a new world record. The money will go toward developing Brazil's petro industry, which involves lots of deep water drilling. That's right. You might ask, don't investors remember a company called BP and their gaffe in the Deepwater Gulf? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Investors don't believe the oil spill in the Gulf will affect drilling in other parts of the world. So says Michael Lynch, president of the consulting firm Strategic Energy and Economic Research.
Most people are treating it as a one-off thing that can be blamed specifically on BP, rather than a question of deepwater drilling being beyond our ability to control.
Why are investors betting specifically on the Brazilian company known as Petrobras?
It's the Willie Sutton rule. This is where the oil is.
A few years ago, Brazil discovered off its coast one of the world's largest oil deposits.
The primary attraction of Petrobras is their growth potential.
That's Alan Good, equity analyst with Morningstar. He says Petrobras is expected to double production in the next 10 years.
So that certainly puts them head and shoulders above any of their competitors.
The government of Brazil will continue to be the largest shareholder. Good says that adds a level of risk since politics could influence business decisions. Brazil's president has said that he'd like to use the country's oil wealth to help lift almost 200 million people out of poverty.
It could be a case where Petrobras is guided to invest in projects that may not deliver higher returns for the purpose of simply stimulating the economy or providing jobs.
In the short term, the money raised on the market will fund investment in the country's oil industry. Within 10 years, Brazil is expected to be one of the top five oil producers in the world. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Some drama today to cap off the debut week of the new television season. Two TV big shots were canceled. At CNN, President John Klein is out. And I've been waiting all day for some kind of tweet from Conan O'Brien about this one. His former boss at NBC, Jeff Zucker, is leaving the Peacock Network. Zucker has been with NBC since the 1980s and the man at the top since 2007. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
If there's one tie that binds these two ousters, it's this.
In television, the ratings numbers really count.
John Lafayette is the business editor at Broadcasting and Cable Magazine.
CNN has fallen behind Fox News, obviously, and have been overtaken by MSNBC, particularly in primetime. And NBC was the fourth rated network last year, and not so long ago, they were a dominant number one.
Lafayette says one reason for those falling ratings at NBC was a short-lived experiment Jeff Zucker will always be remembered for, putting Jay Leno on at 10 p.m. But remember, with a likely takeover from Comcast, Zucker probably would have been replaced anyway. As for John Klein's departure from CNN, analysts say one reason was his decision to move away from spicy opinion shows in primetime and opt for a more middle-of-the-road news approach with mainstays like Larry King.
Why did you change your how did you come up with Lady Gaga?
The future for both companies will probably be all about efficiency. Bill Carroll is the director of programming at the Katz Television Group.
In the same way that every industry is looking at what's the most efficient way of providing the best product, that's what's going to start to happen and has started to happen.
For CNN, Carroll says that means leaner reporting teams and perhaps a link-up with a broadcast network. For NBC, under Comcast, he anticipates more overlap on the entertainment side between cable and broadcast channels. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street ended a fitful week of trading on a positive note. The details when we do the numbers. Listen, can you hear the sound of jingling in the distance? The holidays will be here sooner than a lot of us would like, but they can't come soon enough for retailers who depend on the business they bring in. This week, glad tidings from the appropriately named job placement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. It predicted retailers will hire more seasonal workers this year than last. Macy's and Toys R Us both just announced they'll indeed boost hiring. But what about small businesses, which are widely regarded as the engine of our economy? On the line with us now are Susan Blood and Kevin Tuohy from Nova Natural Toys and Crafts in Vermont. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Kevin, you're the warehouse manager How much help do you think you're going to need this year?
We're looking to hire around 30 people by the time we get up to a full running season.
And how does that compare to last year?
I think last year we had around 14, so it's definitely an increase for us.
Susan, you're the owner of Nova. How has business been this year?
Business has been fairly flat, but we feel lucky to even be flat at this point. We're still hopeful for the holiday season.
It seems to be somewhat counterintuitive, though. You're expecting flat numbers, but you're still talking about hiring more seasonal workers. Why?
Last year, we did a little bit of prospecting.
Hold on, prospecting. What does that mean in your business?
So prospecting means exchanging catalog lists with other companies who we feel have a good match with our customer base. And so that's what we're doing more this year.
We do keep hearing, though, about this concern about a double-dip recession, and retailers have been taking largely a wait-and-see approach to their inventories. So what gives rise to this confidence?
Well, we feel like our audience, parents of children between the ages of just being born and 6 years old, are always buying things for their children. And so we feel like toys from Nova Natural are not necessarily luxury, but something that people are always looking for.
Children are recession-proof, you're saying, huh?
Well, we'll see. We're hopeful.
I have to ask, with so many people looking for jobs right now, what's the application ratio been like?
We're actually a little surprised that it's been down a little bit this year compared to last year. Because we had such a large response last year, we kind of changed the way we looked for applicants this year. And I think it's controlled it a bit. And another thing that's really unusual is that we're getting a lot more people that are looking for part-time work. I think people are really kind of working hard to kind of put together some kind of employment picture for themselves that really works and earns them a bit more money.
When do these seasonal workers get let go?
Usually it's right around December 20th, which is what we call it Drop Dead California. It's the last opportunity to get a package out to the West Coast in time for the holidays.
Drop Dead California. We'll not take that as a personal comment out here.
Exactly.
Susan Blood and Kevin Tuohy of Nova Natural Toys and Crafts in Vermont, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
There was no shortage of business news this week. The shuffling among the president's economic advisors, help for small business, and the stimulating debates over stimulus spending. Here for our look at the week that was on Wall Street and beyond is financial journalist Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Bob.
It's great to be here.
On Thursday, the House passed the Small Business Jobs Act, which expands loans to small businesses, encompasses some ways to raise revenue, and of course, tax breaks. Good or bad, Heidi?
I think it is good, actually. But what it does is kind of repair a mistake that we made in the first TARP stimulus to banks. And in TARP, the government gave billions of dollars to big banks, hoping that they would lend to businesses and small businesses. It didn't exactly work out that way. And so this new small business bill at $30 billion isn't really lending to small businesses. What it's doing is creating a fund to give to banks in the hopes that those banks will then lend to small businesses. So they're hoping that this will be a more effective on-the-ground way to fix the erroneous trickle-down theory that we had before on fixing the banking system.
Felix, the small business people I've heard from have kind of a two-edged response to this. They say, what took so long, and it's not nearly enough.
$30 billion is actually quite a lot of money. And remember, it gets leveraged. So that will, if it works, translate into hundreds of billions of dollars of new lending to small businesses from the banks. And what's more, the banks, you know, they haven't been lending to small businesses. They need to be lending to small businesses because that's where the job creation is.
Let's get to the topic that I know you're both aching to talk about, and that is this pledge to America from the Republicans. Basically, this debate over whether the stimulus did or did not work, it seems to come down to whether the voters think it was the TARP program and the bailout that we spent all that money on, or whether it was the stimulus program. In this case, is perception reality, Heidi?
I think we are forced to go on perception because it is an election year and it is a very contentious one. The reality, however, is that probably all of these programs did a little bit of good. The question is if they did as much good as they were intended to do. Obviously, you've seen a lot of other factors come into what's going on in the midterm elections. It's not just to do with finance. But where it comes to finance, I think the administration can make a pretty good case that at least they try to do something.
Felix, what about this? This perception that voters hate the bailout, but they don't seem quite so cool to the stimulus, but they don't seem to be able to draw clear lines between the two.
Yeah, they have no idea. It's really complicated, and they haven't been paying attention. And they're convinced that TARP was an Obama administration program when it wasn't. It was introduced by George W. Bush. They're convinced it was this big bailout of banks, which it was, but all of that money has pretty much been paid back at this point. Certainly most of it has. And the stimulus, they kind of mix up with TARP, and they aren't quite sure what to think of it, but they know that unemployment has risen, and they're absolutely right about that. So in that sense, yeah, the stimulus failed. You can talk all you like about how unemployment would be even higher if it wasn't for the stimulus, but it didn't do what it was intended to do, which was get more jobs in the economy.
Okay, I've noticed a pretty cynical thread going through this for a Friday, so I have to throw you this one. Anything that made you smile this week, Heidi?
I think that the fact that the administration is actually thinking about its economic leadership is a very good sign. It's good that the economy is actually becoming the number one issue in a thoughtful way and that the administration is willing to pivot and to consider new ideas, not necessarily to stick stubbornly with its old ideas.
Felix, spin us out of here positively on a Friday.
Well, Microsoft managed to borrow money at 0.8%. Basically, money is free right now for big companies. They can use it to buy their stock. They can use it to invest in employees. And free money has got to ultimately pass through into a more vibrant economy. Whether that means more jobs, I don't know. But it certainly means a healthier economy over the medium term, I think.
Financial journalist Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon from Reuters, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Coming up, a restaurant where the customers provide the ingredients.
That night, we took his lettuces and we created a Robert's Coronado Street salad.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 197 points, or 1.8%, to close at 10,860. The NASDAQ gained 54 points, that's 2.3%, to end the day at 2381. The S&P 500 climbed 23 points, 2.1%, to finish at 1148. For the week, the Dow rose 2.4%, the NASDAQ charged up 2.8%, the S&P 500 put on 2.1%. Hertz drove up nearly 7% after making what it calls its best and final offer to buy Dollar Thrifty Automotive Group, which fell 2.5%. Competitor Avis Budget Group revved up 5.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.61%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at Vanguard.com/public radio. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. The National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill opens its third public meeting. It will address the response following the spill and approaches to long-term restoration. The American Film Institute Latin American Film Festival continues in Silver Spring, Maryland. And events in China and other locations around the globe mark World Tourism Day. Tourism and biodiversity is the theme this year. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. On the heels of a series of diplomatic spats between China and Japan, Beijing has cut off exports of 17 rare minerals to its neighbor. Now, we could probably learn to live without all those cheap goods at the discount stores, but it would be quite another matter, a matter of national security, actually, if the whole Western world suffered a cutoff of these vital metals, including those used in precision-guided missile systems. Scott Tong joins me now to discuss the significance of this from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Bob.
You know, I hadn't heard the term rare earth since that band I used to listen to in the 70s. Why are we talking about rare earth now? What's this all about?
Well, these are vital metals that happen to be unpronounceable. I'll give you an example. Dysprosium has qualities that make it a key component in hybrid cars and computer hard drives. Other rare earth metals, we're talking more than a dozen, they go into wind turbines. So the clean tech sector needs this for the future. So does the military, as you just mentioned. These metals go into missile systems and tanks. So increasingly, these are seen as indispensable commodities.
But how did China end up controlling 95% of the market?
Part of the story is just globalization. We all know things get made in China for the low China price. And like other sectors, the industrial ecosystem migrated to China. And China is the hub of now digging these metals out of the ground, separating it, refining it, and market forces is part of the explanation. As far as policy, China has increasingly limited exports, so it holds on to more of it at home. And lots of people in the industry have told me that the unwritten rule is the Chinese tell Western companies that if you want the raw material, you have to move your factory to China, and that sends over jobs and it sends over technology. Now, I do have to tell you, China is not the only place where these minerals are, but in the last couple decades, facilities in the U.S. and elsewhere shut down because the prices were so low given low demand before, so they felt they couldn't make money back then.
But we're seeing this used as a bargaining chip now, so is industry here in the U.S. going to build up again?
The markets are responding. The price of some of these metals has really shot up the last year or so, and the investors are following. I spoke to metals analyst Tracy Wazlowski. And she says the rush into companies that want to reopen some of these mines is what she calls mind-boggling.
The five publicly traded companies that were in that space last year all went up anywhere from 50% plus. Things kind of mellowed out a little bit over last fall, but then they increased again, and most of these stocks are doubling and tripling and quadrupling in price.
Now we're talking, Bob, about mines that could reopen in the U.S., in Canada, in Australia. And given the national security implications, governments may come and help out these sectors as well outside of China. Here in Washington, one government report says the U.S. industry may be 15 years behind China, and there's a military review underway as well. So watch for government action to encourage these sectors.
So what do these latest developments tell us about China, and in particular their apparent willingness to use these resources as sort of a blunt instrument for diplomacy?
This is a new chapter in China and resources, Bob. Usually, China has to go out to the rest of the world to buy the stuff, to buy the iron ore, to buy the oil. And now, China has the stuff and some leverage, which was anticipated. The Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping, back in the 80s and 90s, he said that the Middle East has oil, but China has rare earth metals. Hmm. And one industry observer says it appears that China is taking this leverage out for a spin to see how the world responds.
And that may be what we're seeing in Japan. Scott Tong from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, you're going to be following this story. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Who needs a big produce delivery truck or even a trip to the local farmer's market? These days, some restaurants grow their own fresh and natural produce. You might see the chef picking the basil for that night's pesto. But here's the seed of a new idea from a restaurant in Los Angeles. Have customers grow the food. This place takes tangerines, peppers, or potatoes from backyard gardens and puts them on the menu. Marketplace's Eve Troe has the story.
Home gardeners love to share their yield. Robert Coughlin is no exception. His 14-square-foot plot is just dirt right now. It's resting. But this spring, it was full of lettuce.
red oak leaf and curly leaf lettuce, romaine lettuce, and two kinds of arugula that I grew.
He delivered weekly to everyone he knew.
My friends were like, enough, Robert.
Coughlin took the teasing in stride until he saw his lettuce going to waste.
I opened a fridge and I saw that the last week's supply was uneaten.
A friend told him about Forage, a trendy new restaurant less than a mile from Coughlin's home in the Silver Lake neighborhood. The chef there would take produce from local gardeners, but the veggies had to audition.
I was a little intimidated. He was breaking the leaves and smelling them and tasting them and really looking to see if they were something that he could benefit from.
Forage's chef, Jason Kim, took every leaf.
That night, we took his lettuces and we created Robert's Coronado Street Salad.
So Robert brought more lettuce, and Kim would often serve it still warm from the sun. Kim used to work in high-end restaurants that charged a lot for specialty produce like this. He wanted to serve fresh food at cheaper prices. That's why he started Forage. But he says his first thought about using amateur growers was, no thanks.
Some old lady with the bag of lemons coming in and being like, you know, give me money for these lemons.
But he tried, and to Kim's surprise, dozens of hip urban farmers came out of the woodwork. They didn't even want money. Like Robert Coughlin, they just didn't want to waste what they grew. Coughlin says Kim made him a deal.
He said, maybe we could do food credits on a card. And I said, okay, cool, because I figured I could bring friends there and take them to lunch on the food card.
And he did.
Robert was pointing to the salad, telling all his friends, that's my lettuce.
Chef Kim pays most local growers with credit. They've supplied up to 35% of produce served at Forage. And the unique things they grow give the restaurant a leg up on the competition.
Just really rare stuff that I say nobody else in L.A. gets.
Like a pile of striped white and purple orbs from one grower.
These are Italian heirloom eggplants. Never seen eggplants like these until he brought them.
Kim might roast them with garlic to put on crostini. But city regulators raised their eyebrows at the program and cracked down on Forage earlier this year. How did Kim really know where the produce came from, they asked, and who was accountable if someone got sick?
They said that we are not allowed to take in stuff from unapproved sources.
It took Kim months just to figure out what that meant. He helped some of his best growers get certified through the same process used for farmers markets. Robert Coughlin shows off his state certificate.
Yellowneck squash, zucchini.
It lists what he can grow, including each kind of tomato.
Japanese black truffle, a black Inca tomato, pineapple tomatoes, and then the red beefsteak.
Now more Forage growers want to get certified. Recently, students from a local elementary school came by to show Chef Kim a green squash they grew. It has a very long, thin neck. No one had ever seen anything like it. Kim couldn't serve it, but he still found a way to use it as decoration for the Forage display case. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by DeluxeCorp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, you might remember the airlines are under new rules limiting tarmac delays to 3 hours before passengers have to be allowed to deplane. United Airlines had a couple of delays that ran more than 3 hours in May, and it reported them to the Transportation Department. Thing is, the carrier followed the rules because it had offered to let passengers disembark. And it still got hit with a $12,000 fine anyway. That's because its report to the government wasn't necessary. DOT's consent order explains it this way: United's misreporting of this data wasted valuable department resources. So much for better safe than sorry. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 197 points, or 1.8%. The Nasdaq gained 54 points. That's 2.3%. The S&P 500 climbed 23 points, 2.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a dramatic interpretation that makes sense of the ongoing healthcare saga.
Hello, I'm an actor playing Lou Felice.
Insurance companies want Lou to expand the definition of healthcare so that they can keep more profit.
Tune in to the Healthcare Reform Chronicles. I'm Bob Moon. Guy's back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.